This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, May 26th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last Saturday, an American drone strike killed the Taliban's leader, Mullah Mansour. President Obama confirmed the death on Monday.
He is an individual who, as head of the Taliban, was specifically targeting U.S. personnel and troops inside of Afghanistan who are there as part of the mission that I've set to be able to maintain a counterterrorism platform and provide assistance and training to the Afghan military forces there. We are not re-entering the day-to-day combat operations that are currently being conducted by Afghan security forces. Our job is to help Afghanistan secure its own country.
George Packer joins me to discuss why the Taliban is resurgent and how the instability in Afghanistan could affect the presidential campaign in the United States. Hi, George.
Hi, Dorothy.
So this should be good news for Presidents Obama and Ghani, but why do I sense that it may not be as simple as that?
Because this war has been going on more or less for 14 years, and we always think we're about to turn a corner. We always think if only we get rid of this or that leader, including Osama bin Laden, somehow it's going to take the air out of the insurgency and leave an Afghanistan that's good enough for us to get out. And it just doesn't happen. And it's not going to happen for a long, long time. And our time horizon is so different from the possible chart of progress in Afghanistan. They're completely mismatched.
I think a lot of Americans, partly because they're so tied up in the current presidential election, are not even aware that the Taliban now has retaken huge sections of Afghanistan. How much territory do they now control?
They control parts of many provinces, including very large ones such as Helmand and Orzgun and Badakhshan in the north. They control dozens and dozens of districts. Now, control may mean they have all but the government center, which means almost total control or including the government center. Or it may mean that, you know, by day, the Afghan National Army has checkpoints set up and the Taliban don't have free passage everywhere, but at night the Taliban can move. So it's a gray and nuanced definition. But the key thing is that they're expanding their territorial control, and that's going to continue as the fighting season intensifies this year. And in fact, the fighting season never really ended. The Taliban had been gaining ground continuously since the pullout of American and NATO forces.
And this leads to a question that's really lingered since the George W. Bush administration, which is, are we creating more terrorists than we're eliminating, whatever the tactic is? In this case, it's a drone strike.
Well, at this point, our presence is rather small. There are about 9,500 American trainers and special forces and other kinds of troops. We are theoretically not involved in combat. In practice, the distinction starts to melt down. Anyone who reads the report of the bombing of the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz realizes that Americans are involved in combat. There's no way we can stay out or else provincial capitals like Kunduz would fall. But we're not involved to nearly the degree we were in 2010, 2011, when there were 100,000 American troops. So it's not as though the day-to-day reality of American troops is creating so much friction with civilian casualties and checkpoints and the horrendous effects of an occupation. So the Taliban have sort of lost that narrative. The drone strike may begin to give them, you know, a new case that, well, the Americans still are fighting and killing us. But really, this is much more of an Afghan war at this point. And what the Taliban are benefiting from is not the American presence, but the weakness, the failure, the ongoing corruption of the Afghan government. And that's always been the Taliban's great strength, is the weakness of the Afghan government, along with the support they get continuously from the Pakistani government.
And there's a relatively new president, President Ghani, who replaced Karzai, and that was a bit of a relief. But of course, he, as you point out, he inherited a complete nightmare at a time when U.S. troops were leaving. You were in Kabul recently. Tell us a little bit about him and whether anyone actually could succeed in running this particular failed state.
Ashraf Ghani literally wrote the book on fixing failed states. That's the title of a book he co-authored and whose ideas are largely his. And now he's in the unlikely position of having the chance to put those ideas into practice. And needless to say, it's not as easy as it might look on paper. Afghanistan's economy has collapsed because it was largely sustained by foreign troops and foreign money and foreign contracts. And those have departed in great numbers since 2014. And militarily, because of the same phenomenon, the Afghan National Army, which is actually fighting and fighting rather intensively and sustaining heavy, heavy casualties that we never read about, is nonetheless outmatched in many places by the Taliban. And by the lack of a government presence, it would sustain a government military operation and control. So the same old problems are still there, except they're worse because of the departure of so much foreign support. And Ghani inherited that. It was a terrible hand that he was dealt. And he's now trying to implement all the recommendations in his various books and articles, as well as to play the game of politics in Kabul, which is a nasty, tricky game. And the rap on him is that he doesn't play that game very well.
And what you were saying to me the other day, it sounds like the U.S. Embassy is really alarmed.
You know, I didn't speak to our ambassador, but I've spoken to a lot of U.S. diplomats who know Afghanistan, and their confidence in Ghani is shaky, and their sense of the momentum and the tempo of the war is quite desperate. One person in Kabul who I can't identify said to me, this is the year of living dangerously. It's the year that the government makes it or it falls.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The peace talks with the Taliban in January, which included China, the U.S., Pakistan, and Afghanistan, failed. These efforts have been underway for many years now. Is there any evidence that the Taliban wants peace? And if so, what would the demands be?
No, they've never issued demands. They've never presented a political program. They're very opaque in terms of their war aims. They do have an office in Doha, in Qatar, where they carry on talks with non-Afghan or U.S. government people, so-called Track 2 talks. But those seem almost like a distraction from the war, because the war goes on and on and on, and more Afghans are killed. It's just a horror what the people of that country have endured over more than 30 years, 35 years now. And Mullah Mansour, who was recently eliminated from existence, was particularly adamant about not talking. He embarrassed his Pakistani patrons by having these four-way talks, U.S., Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, lead to nothing, including no Taliban participation. And one reason is the Taliban have been making a tremendous amount of money from narcotics and other contraband trafficking across the border from Helmand province into Balochistan, Pakistan. And Mansour was heavily involved in that. So the war is partly a criminal operation, and it's been a lucrative one, and there's just very little obvious interest in why the Taliban would come to the table. They seem to be winning on the battlefield. They are enriching themselves. Maybe they look at Kabul and say, the business of governing this country is so hard that we're happy to be in the field making money and winning battles.
And what about the new leader? What do we know about him?
Very little. His name is Sheikh Hibatullah. He is a religious credentialed figure, which Mullah Mansour was not. He doesn't have military experience. He was a judge during the Taliban period in Afghanistan. And from what I understand, he was a kind of weak consensus choice of the leadership that was in shock
because of the death of Mullah Mansour. And we really should talk about what a shock that was, because the U.S. has never targeted with a drone strike a leader of the Afghan Taliban. We've targeted al-Qaeda figures in Pakistan. We've targeted Pakistani Taliban figures. But we have not done this until now and not done it outside the tribal areas.
So what's the significance of that?
I think it's a kind of finger in the eye to the Pakistanis, a way of saying, you said you could deliver the Taliban to peace talks. You didn't. You said that you want to start playing a constructive role in the region with Chinese backing for that. You haven't. You continue to play the same double game that you've always played. If we have this guy in our sights, what sensitivities are we required to respect in holding on and not pulling the trigger?
You've written extensively about the legacy of Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What do you think Obama's legacy is going to be? How have we gotten from the Petraeus doctrine of counterinsurgency to Obama's policy of deploying special forces and drones and these targeted strikes?
He is stuck. That's his legacy. He is stuck in a part of the world that he has told us he thinks is a kind of losing bet. He would have preferred to leave to its own devices more and to focus on parts of the world that seem to be more constructive, like Vietnam, where he just visited. So he can't get out. The counterterrorism model, which seemed like a wonderful alternative to the high casualty counterinsurgency model, doesn't seem to be working any better. And in fact, because we're there in such small numbers and because we don't have the intelligence we used to that came from having all these boots on the ground, it's leading to a fairly rapid disintegration of the position of the Afghan government. And Obama's attempt to get out, you know, we ended a combat mission and we declared we would go down to 5,000 troops. We're still above that, and we probably will be for the rest of the year and into next year, because the alternative is to see the collapse of the Afghan government. And apparently that is a line that Obama just will not cross.
And that brings us back to the U.S. presidential campaign. Here's what Trump recently said in a foreign policy speech at the Center for the National Interest.
We went from mistakes in Iraq to Egypt to Libya to President Obama's line in the sand in Syria. Each of these actions have helped to throw the region into chaos and gave ISIS the space it needs to grow and prosper. Very bad. It all began with a dangerous idea that we could make Western democracies out of countries that had no experience or interest in becoming a Western democracy.
George, say what you will about Trump. This much, at least, is sort of hard to argue with.
It's a really potent argument, and it's going to carry a lot of weight during the campaign. It's not as though we got into Afghanistan with wild-eyed Jeffersonian idealism. We went in there because we perceived it as an incubator of a threat, an unacceptable threat. But inevitably, once you go in, you get pulled into efforts to reform and change the politics and culture of these societies in order for the threat not to keep recurring. And that's happened in Afghanistan, and Obama is now stuck with it.
So Trump, as we know, grossly oversimplifies. Clinton complicates. She has a great deal of experience in foreign policy. But is it possible in this wild election that that could be an albatross?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, although I've just picked apart a little bit of what Trump said, it's going to be a really powerful argument and one that Hillary Clinton is going to be hard-pressed to challenge, because she has her vote on the Iraq war on her hands. She has her time as Secretary of State, her support for the surge in Afghanistan, her support for the overthrow of Gaddafi. I mean, she is an activist on this stuff and a hawkish activist. And unless there's a terrorist attack of the moment that seems to drive the polls in the direction of intervention, that is not where the American people are, and Trump knows it. So he has a really strong argument that is going to keep Hillary Clinton on the defensive.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thanks so much, George.
You're welcome.
George Packer is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary from George Packer and others on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.